Sports Weekend All. Listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
This is Dan Friedel, and for VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, welcome to the Sunny Side of Sports. It's Friday, December 27th, and how about that with the midweek Christmas, which already makes it seem like the weekend, and then 2 days go by, and it actually is the weekend. And this weekend has plenty of sporty activities, which we'll look forward to, including a handful of solid NBA games and another round of English Premier League matches, even after all the Boxing Day games on Thursday. So, speaking of Boxing Day, a quick recap of the key games from Thursday in England. Tottenham continued its winning ways after the signing of Jose Mourinho by defeating Brighton 2-1. Liverpool defeated Leicester City 4-0, and other winners included Manchester United, Crystal Palace, Aston Villa, and Everton. Speaking of soccer, we're joined now by Samson O'Malle, who starts his report with a look ahead to this weekend's matches in the CAF Champions League group stage.
News from the CAF Champions League, where TP Mazembe, Esperance de Tunis and Etoile du Sahel will look to continue their perfect starts in the 2019-2020 Elite Club Competition group stage this weekend. DR Congo's TP Mazembe will be looking to record their third successive win in Group A when they face Angolan side CD Primeiro de Agosto in Luanda on Friday. TP Mazembe's local rivals, AS Vita Club, will also be in action on Friday when they lock horns with the defending champions and Tunisian giants Esperance de Tunis in a Group D match in Raids. 5 games are scheduled to be played on Saturday, and the action will be headlined by an encounter between Kabylie's local rivals, USM Alger, and South African champions Mamelodi Sundowns. Sundowns remain undefeated in the group stage, having registered a win and a draw, while Alger are winless, having recorded 2 draws, and the 2 teams will clash in Blinda in the Group C match. Lastly, Tunisian side Etoile du Sahel will be hoping to continue their dominance in Group B by recording their 3rd consecutive win when they take on Sudanese outfit Al-Hilal Omdurman in Raids. Staying with football news, the Japan under-23 squad will warm up for the 2020 Tokyo Olympics with friendlies against 2 African countries, South Africa and Cote d'Ivoire. Hajime Moriyasu's squad will face South Africa at Kyoto's Sanga Stadium on March 27th before meeting Cote d'Ivoire at Level 5 Stadium in Fukuoka 3 days later. Both of the African sides have qualified for the Summer Olympics, where the men's soccer tournament is to be contested by under-23 sides containing a limited number of overage players. They will be joined by Egypt, which also secured Olympic qualification at the 2019 Africa Under-23 Cup of Nations. Away from football news, the 22nd edition of the African Championships in Athletics is set to take place from the 24th to the 28th of June 2020. Ahead of the championship, the Confederation of African Athletics is working in collaboration with the Algerian Athletics Federation to organize a successful championships where the best of African athletes will converge on the Algerian capital, Algiers. The stakes of the competition are quite high, as it will be one of the last opportunities for the continent's athletes to achieve qualifying standards for the 2020 Olympic Games. I am Samson O'Malle in Abuja, Nigeria.
Thank you, Samson, and we hope you have a great weekend. I'm Dan Friedel in for Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. Next up, following along with African soccer, we have this wrap-up of the year for Uganda's national men's side, the Cranes, from our friend Mugume Davis Rakarinj in Kampala. Sporty greetings, Mugume.
Uganda Cranes qualified with a game to spare for this year's Egypt African Cup of Nations. At the finals, they did not disappoint. The Cranes beat rivals DR Congo 2-0 and drew against Zimbabwe to qualify for the next round, to the excitement of fans.
Oh, my name is Nicholas. I'm just so happy, so amazing that we beat Congo. It was just unexpected, but we're so happy. 2 wonderful goals, a lot of shots on targets, a lot of possession. We're happy with our coach.
The Cranes were to succumb to a 1-0 defeat against eventual finalist Senegal. Head coach Sebastian Desabre was replaced by Jonathan McKinstry, who promised to play exciting football and said he'll be targeting a qualification for both the AFCON and the World Cup. Indeed, McKinstry started with a point against Burkina Faso and a win against Malawi Flames at Nambole in 2021 Cameroon AFCON qualifier. McKinstry is glad with the team's performance. He is particularly pleased that he has been able to win the just-concluded Council for Central and East African Football Association, or CECAFA Senior Challenge Cup, held in Kampala this month. Uganda Cranes beat Eritrea 3-0 at the finals.
You know, the Uganda Cranes have qualified for the last two African Cup of Nations, and some people might expect that players maybe relax after that, but that's not the case here. The players, whether they're based here in Uganda or they're based at foreign clubs, are all hungry for success. They want more. You know, the taste they've had of AFCON has given them an appetite, and they want to improve. And that's a great environment to be working in.
Sports reporter and analyst John Vianney Simbe says Uganda has become a dominant force in the region.
If you look at the CECAFA Under-17 Girls Championship, Uganda won it after winning the COSAFA as well. The COSAFA is a Southern African, of course, a championship that has countries like South Africa, Namibia, and the likes. And Uganda's under-17 girls still went there and won the championship. Now, for the men, it's no question that if you look at the way the team has qualified for the Africa Cup of Nations two times in a row.
Former Uganda Cranes captain Geoffrey Massa agrees.
It has been the best year ever in Uganda history. Going through knockout stages in AFCON qualifiers, the team is always in camp 2 weeks before the tournament. It's very great. And you can see, I think Uganda have a very good talented players.
Massa captained and helped the Uganda Cranes to qualify for Gabon AFCON in 2017 after 39 years of absence. Uganda Cranes' next engagement will be participation at the 2020 African Nations Championship, or CHAN, in April next year. And then AFCON qualifier against neighbor South Sudan. For the Sunny Side of Sports, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda. Wishing all Sunny Side of Sports listeners pleasant festivities and a sporty 2020.
Thank you, Mugume. Let's look now at the NBA as we wrap up 2019.
Now the Warriors just inbound, and that's it. There's a new NBA champion, and it's a team from Toronto, Canada. We the North are now we the champions, the Raptors, the 2019 NBA champs.
As you remember, that was the call on ESPN of the final second of the Toronto Raptors Game 6 win over the Golden State Warriors on that night in Oakland, California. I'm joined now on the Sunny Side of Sports by Morgan Campbell, a sports writer in Toronto who grew up in Canada and has followed the evolution of the Raptors since they joined the league in 1995. I asked Morgan about how it felt to see the Raptors win the championship after all these years and how they did it.
Yeah, absolutely. Because there are a few things you have to keep in mind, and some of them on the back end will be of, you know, particular interest to your audience on this show in your region. But one is that the city of Toronto has not had a championship team in a major league sport since 1993. So, you know, it was 26 years before the Major League Baseball team, the Blue Jays, that they hadn't won. The hockey team, the Toronto Maple Leafs, they haven't won since the 1960s. The Raptors, their first season was 1995, so they have gone 23 seasons without a championship. So in their 24th season, they win this championship. And so this is a huge moment in Toronto because Toronto has been waiting for so long for a championship team at that level. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that Toronto is a tremendously multicultural city. And so, like, the mainstream sports media were really surprised at the popularity of the Raptors and the multicultural nature of the audience that the Raptors attracted. But that's mainly because, like, the people in the mainstream media are generally older than the Raptors audience, and they're a lot whiter than the Raptors audience, like white Anglo-English-speaking Canadians, who didn't really see this coming because that just wasn't the demographic, you know, that the team appealed to. And guys their age and of their ethnic background weren't really into basketball, whereas, like, people under 45, let's say, grew up with basketball and were into basketball even before the Raptors came. So then they were like this audience, like not even a latent audience, like an audience that was already waiting for the Raptors when the Raptors arrived. So the Raptors, even in the 90s, didn't have to create an audience because this younger multicultural crowd for Toronto, they were already there, already watching like the Chicago Bulls and the Los Angeles Lakers of the 80s and 90s. So they were really ready for basketball. So this championship was like a big payoff and like the culmination of so much hope and longing and dedication for a broad cross section of Torontonians. And then the third thing is, again, for your audience, the turning point for this franchise is really when Masai Ujiri, born and raised in Nigeria, really gets to take control of this franchise as the team president and starts making these decisions to build this team long term. Because one of the things that's unique about the Raptors, right, is that they were one of the first NBA teams to take their development league team and really use it to develop talent as opposed to just using it kind of as an afterthought. So there are guys in the starting lineup and who get a lot of minutes with the Raptors right now, Fred VanVleet, Norman Powell, and now this year Chris Boucher, guys who weren't necessarily heralded coming out of college and who had to go play in the developmental league, but the Raptors took their developmental league team more seriously than other teams did, and that enabled them to develop the type of talent that put them over the top. And that was a Masai Ujiri initiative. So if you don't have him making decisions like that, if you don't have Masai Ujiri like making that trade, trading DeMar DeRozan, who was tremendously popular, trading him and bringing Kawhi Leonard, and getting rid of Dwayne Casey, who was tremendously popular, just to get a coach who could get them, you know, a few more regular season wins. Like, these are all risky decisions, but they paid off for the Raptors. But again, the difference between the Raptors being a playoff team and being a championship team, a lot of that starts and ends with Masai Ujiri.
I'm Dan Friedel, and for Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports. We're talking with Morgan Campbell, a sports writer in Toronto, Canada, about the Raptors NBA title back in June. I asked Morgan, as he just mentioned, about the Raptors' two big offseason moves heading into the 2018-2019 season, and those moves were acquiring Kawhi Leonard in a trade with the San Antonio Spurs and firing longtime head coach Dwayne Casey.
Trading DeMar DeRozan for Kawhi Leonard, as popular as DeMar DeRozan was, and he had, you know, a deep and still has a deep following, loyal following here in Toronto, people that really follow basketball understood that you kind of have to make that move. And that is an upgrade from, like, DeRozan is a very good player. Kawhi Leonard, especially last season, was top three or four in the league. And because if you're top three or four in the league, like, by definition, there's only three or four guys in the league who are anywhere near as good as you are. So if you get a chance to get one of those guys, you have to take it, even if it means trading someone who's really popular. So fans, even though they were sad to see DeMar DeRozan leave town, understood that that's the kind of move you have to make. Now, firing Dwayne Casey was a little bit different, right? Because here is the most successful single-season coach in the history of the franchise. 59 regular season teams, 59 regular season wins. No other coach had accomplished that, but they just kept running into the Cleveland Cavaliers in the playoffs. And I want to say it was 3 out of 4 years got eliminated by LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers. And there's not a lot you can do to control that because James is one of the two or three greatest players ever. But the point is, you fire that guy because on the one hand, you're sending the message to the fan base that like only a championship will satisfy you, that your main measure of success now is championships, and whoever doesn't deliver a championship isn't doing the job. But on the other hand, you're sending the message to all of these potential coaches who you might want to hire to replace Dwayne Casey that you could be the most successful coach in franchise history and still get fired. So if I'm coming from outside the organization, what I see in that transaction is a lot of – if I come to the Raptors, there's a lot of ways for me to fail and not very many ways for me to succeed. And that's part of the reason why they kind of had trouble filling that job and wound up promoting – Dwayne Casey's assistant, Nick Nurse, but it worked out well. It turned out that Nick Nurse was ready for that type of promotion. But firing Casey, to me, was the much riskier transaction. Like trading for Kawhi Leonard. It's unpopular with DeMar DeRozan's fans, but it's not a risk because Leonard has been and still is a demonstrably better player than DeMar DeRozan. But getting rid of the most successful coach you've ever had, that's a risk. That was a gamble, and it paid off for Jerry.
That's sports writer Morgan Campbell in Toronto. We'll have more with Morgan next week. Now to pick up Sonny's chat with Andy Edwards from Christmas Day. Sonny and Andy were talking about the evolution of running shoe technology, which may have helped recent marathon runners push the limit on how fast they can cover 26.2 miles.
When Kenenisa Bekele ran that wonderful time in Berlin, he was wearing the Nike Vaporfly shoes. Eliud Kipchoge wore them to break 2 hours in Vienna. He's worn them for the world record in Berlin. And Bridget Koskay wore them to break the women's world record in Chicago. I know there are the various forms of the Vaporfly, but it's basically, it's that core design. Is the key to success the Vaporfly shoe technology, which Nike have created? The heel is higher, it looks different. I haven't worn them, but we're going to hear from somebody who has. And also, what seems to be a crucial component, well, two components, the carbon fiber plate and the midsole foam. I've heard regular, average runners like me say the midsole foam is its biggest asset. Now, I live in North London. I know quite a few runners in the area. And I know some of them have been wearing the Vaporfly for much of this year. They're very much average club mass ability. They do marathons and cross country. So I thought it'd be interesting to hear the thoughts of a guy called Jim Connell. He's 47, runs for a London club called Heathside, and chiefly does road and cross country races. His marathon best is 2 hours 57. Now that's a very decent time, but it's not world class. You know, Eliud Kipchoge and Kenenisa Bekele are not going to get worried if Jim Connell is lining up on the start line. So, Sonny, I got in touch with Jim through mutual friends, and Jim and I met in a cafe in North London, not too far away from the VOA office in the heart of London. We met last week before Jim went off to run the Malaga Marathon in Spain, where, incidentally, he wore Vaporfly and ran 3 hours 9 minutes. So, again, another good time. So this is how Jim Connell, average runner, 47 years of age, came to wear the Vaporfly.
The shoe was described to me as a game changer, and I felt that I was never going to buy this shoe because I always considered Nike to be the devil and that you were just paying for a tick. But when I saw other friends getting great results, I thought, let's try a pair out. And I was told that I could put them on straight out of the box. The shoe does feel like a game changer, certainly in the longer distance races. When I start to feel very tired, I do feel like I'm able to maintain good form.
After initial doubt, Jim was won over Andy. But how did he do in races?
Well, it turns out he's been doing pretty well, not just in the marathon, but at half marathon as well. Now have a listen to this next clip from Jim. When he mentions running Boston Marathon, didn't do too well there, but then he later told me after our interview that although he had to walk in Boston, the hills proved tough for him. A few weeks later, he came back and feeling he had all the marathon training still in him, he ran a much flatter marathon, Milton Keynes, that's in central England, and he did 3:02, so just outside 3 hours in the Vaporflies. Here's Jim again.
The week before, I ran a 1:26 in the big half London half marathon, and that was my kind of goal race for the spring, like my goal tune-up race. But then I had an extra place offered to me in the London Landmarks half marathon, and I thought, let's give the Vaporflies a go because I want to put them on for Boston, which I did this year. So I put them on at the London Landmarks. It was a particularly good day. I wouldn't say it's a faster course, and I ran 2.5 minutes faster.
And Andy, here is how Jim's clubmates reacted when he told them he was wearing those shoes. The Vaporfly has aroused controversy because some people consider them exceeding what should be allowed for running shoes.
At first, they were a bit cynical about it, saying, oh, you know, it's a trainer, it's the runner that does the running, not the shoe. But slowly, the results are coming in and people are buying them.
It was clear to me from talking with Jim that he sees the Vaporfly as enhancing his racing ability. He says you still have to do the training, but interesting how he talked about they reduced his fatigue. He could still feel up, you know, when you know, you run, I run, other runners, and we're kind of ordinary mortals. We're not Eliud Kipchoge and Bridget Koskay. When you get tired, especially towards the end of the race, there's that feeling you're sinking down. But if you can keep that up feeling towards the end of a marathon, that's what Jim felt Vaporfly gave him. He said in contrast, in standard road running shoes, he would tend to be dropping down more onto his heels because he simply got tired. He was still perhaps a little tired, but the fatigue level was different. So they helped him remain more on the forefoot, getting better push-off. Now, I have read some tests in running magazines pointing to these shoes saving on energy. On the other hand, in terms of economics, they are expensive. And Jim said he doesn't wear them outside of races. They wear out quickly. So that's another factor which, along with their design, which I think World Athletics, the governing body for international athletics, is going to need to review. Because here's the quote from the World Athletics rule book when it comes to shoes. Just to put it in context, you know, if you're wearing track spikes, they have to meet certain specifications. And that is also true of for the road running shoes. So here's what the rule book says now. Any type of shoe used must be reasonably available to all in the spirit of the universality of athletics. So that's also saying, in theory, the ideal is athletics, a sport that anybody can practice. You get a pair of trainers. Well, of course, these days we know a lot of trainers cost a lot. And are they within the pocket of people outside the Western world? But just as the design of running shoes for elite and the mass runners has changed dramatically in the last 50 years, Jim Connell believes this development cannot be revoked.
I do see it as the next step in development, yes. It's evolution. We have tennis rackets that are much bigger, made of graphite. You know, they used to be little wooden rackets. We have, you know, even 5 years ago, Adidas brought out a shoe with a different type of foam called the Boost. That was a game changer at the time. I didn't buy into it then. I think this is more of a game changer, but I do see it as natural progression. I think the other shoe brands will be following suit.
Andy, it looks like there'll be more of those elite runners wearing those Vaporfly shoes when they line up for the Olympic marathons next year in Japan. I was going to say Tokyo, except now it looks like those races plus the Olympic walks will be held in the somewhat cooler climate of Sapporo rather than Tokyo.
Well, on my travels for the sunny side of sports throughout 2019, I happened to meet at Frankfurt Marathon, actually, in October, a leading British woman runner about this change of venue. Now, Steph Twell in Frankfurt ran the Olympic qualifying time. She did very well. She is a Scot. She broke the Scottish record, and that had been held by someone who some of your listeners who follow athletics for a long time may remember, Liz McColgan, who won the 1991 World 10,000 metre title. So Steph Twell has been consistent. She's run in two Olympics at 10,000 metres, but I think now she's found her event, and that's the marathon. So she is looking forward. Selection for the Olympics not absolutely guaranteed, but she's certainly in the driving seat. Now, her view was the switch from Tokyo to Sapporo. She approves of that, and she's happy with the change.
That's Sonny talking with Andy Edwards about some of the distance running news from 2019. Thanks to you both. And that wraps up the December 27th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Workinger. Thanks also to VOA engineer Thomas Blondet. And thank you for tuning in. I'm Dan Friedel, in for VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. I'll be back on Monday and Tuesday. And that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
I get it.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa.
Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hello, this is James Butty, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
This is Science in a Minute.
University of Copenhagen researchers have extracted a complete human genome from 5,700-year-old chewing gum. They say it's the first time an entire ancient human genome has been extracted from anything other than human bones. The chewing gum, which is actually pitch or tar extracted from a birch tree, was found during archaeological excavations in southern Denmark. The scientists say they were also able to extract DNA from oral microorganisms and key human pathogens. After analyzing the genome, the scientists found that the ancient gum chewer was a female and was more closely related genetically to people from mainland Europe than those who lived in Scandinavia at the time. The genome also revealed that she probably had dark skin, dark hair, and blue eyes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hi, my name is Larry London. Tune in on January 3rd at 1500 Universal for an interesting program on border crossings featuring the songs with time in the title. It's the new year, 2020 is here, and we'll be playing songs from Michael Jackson, Ariana Grande, Justin Bieber, all the hits with the word time in the title. See you at 1500 Universal on January 3rd, right here on Border Crossings.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our programs, such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on The Voice of America.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscasts covering Africa and the world news. Tune in on top of each hour, 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall.